Sammy Rangel was 11 years old when he ran away from home. He ran away from home because he realized that home was not a place where there was any sense of love, any sense of welcome. In fact, he ran away from home and says that when he ran away from home, he ran away because he understood that, in fact, he was unlovable, that there was no place that could welcome him. Sammy Rangel, at 11 years old, found himself on the streets of the town of where he was. And 11 years old, young man at 11 but fairly large, found his way very quickly into the very kinds of things that you might think a person might find on the streets. He became involved with gangs. He became involved with sex and drugs and all sorts of other things. And at age, and as a young teenager, he began to fight, and to fight a lot. And it was that fighting event that led him to being imprisoned as a teenager, but his fighting had been so violent that they locked him up into an adult penitentiary. And there in the adult prison, Sammy Rangel discovered that his ability or his willingness to fight at any cost earned him some props within the community there, and so he continued to fight and to fight and to fight. But because he had been convicted as a teenager, he was not one that they could keep very long into adulthood, and so they let him out. And soon after they let him out, that fighting continued on. And that fighting continued on, and it moved from fighting, it moved to a place of contempt and hate for everything. And all that had been done to him as a child was now being played out in the way that he lived in contempt and hate to everyone, and you can well imagine that it wasn't long before he was back, going back to prison. And going back to prison, he came to the prison where he had first been sent, and there at the gates of the prison guards said, "Oh no, we do not have the capacity for this person here." And Sammy Rangel, when he tells his story, he says, "What does it mean about how unloved and unwanted you are when even the prisons will close their gates to you?" And so they sent him eventually to another, much more higher security prison. And there Sammy continued his fighting and hateful and vengeful ways. And then he was asked to participate, not asked, he was told to participate in a group therapy session. Sammy Rangel had learned the truth at that point that in order to get along, you play along, and so this was part of playing along. Had no desire to be at any group therapy session. There was nothing that anyone could do for him. The world was out to get him, and he was out to get the world, but he had to go to the session. So he went to the session, and while he was there at the session, the therapist looked at Sammy, and the therapist put an empty chair right in front of Sammy, and he asked him a question. Asked him a series of questions that were like a jolt to his entire system. A jolt so much that the way in which the dots of his life that he had rearranged in such a way that were filled with venom and hate got all of a sudden rearranged. Because what the therapist said was, "I want you, Sammy, to imagine sitting in that chair right there in front of you is your mother." And Sammy looked at the therapist and said, "Why would I want to look at my mother? My mother is the one who started the abuse. My mother is the one who enabled the abuse that was part of my life. Why would I want to look at her?" And the therapist said, "I want you to sit there and I want you to tell your mother what you would like to tell her." And a spew of venom began to come out of Sammy as he began to tell his mother there in that empty chair of all that had been done and all that was his life. And then the therapist asked him this question. Said, Sammy, have you ever done to others what your mother has done to you?" And when he tells that story, and you can look it up on TED Talks, when he tells that story, now years later, Sammy Rangel still begins to tear up. Because he realized that all that hate and that venom that he had been living out of, all that fighting and all that violence that had been part of his life, was merely a way to pay back what his mother had done to him, and he had done it tenfold, multifold, more folds than you could count. And he said, from that point on, I realized that was the turning point in my life. From that point on, I realized that I could do that no more. That in fact, from that point on, my life was going to be a life of trying to pay back that damage which I had done. Sammy Rangel went on to be the co-director, executive director of an organization called Life After Hate. And Life After Hate is an organization that works with folks like him that have been in gangs, that have been in white supremacy movements, neo-Nazi movements, that have lived lives that are filled with violence, and trying to teach them that there is life after hate. That one moment, that one question, like that, rearranged the dots of his life to create a different constellation that was filled now with life and possibility and hope. Stigridge Russ read for us the story of another person filled with hate and venom. The Apostle Paul is not the same person as Sammy Rangel. We have no idea. We really don't know what the Apostle Paul's life was growing up. We don't know whether he was an abused child or anything like that. We do know that later on he talks about the thorn in his side. We have no idea what was the thorn in Paul's side or whatever it is. But what we do know is what is described there in Acts is that as the Apostle Paul is on his way to Damascus, the way he is described is one who is still breathing hate and death. Breathing hate and death, has gotten the papers from the high priest in Jerusalem to go and seek out the followers of this Jesus and to bind them up and deliver them back to Jerusalem, where they would be tried and in many and perhaps killed. We know that the Apostle Paul, before he is the Apostle Paul, we know that he was present at and perhaps participating at the stoning of Stephen, the very first Christian martyr that is recorded in the Bible. We know that Paul, like Sammy Rangel, for whatever reason, at this moment in his life, is breathing venom and hate. And it's not an empty chair looking at his mother that is the jolt to Paul, to Saul. It is literally a bolt out of the sky. It is a bright light that hits him and knocks him off of the horse that he is riding on and leaves him blind, leaves him with his eyes open but unable to see. If that doesn't describe the way many of us are in our world already, eyes open but unable to see, well, for Saul, eyes are open and unable to see. Now, his story will continue, and he will not remain in that sightless place. He will, in fact, as the story continues, find his way to that renewal that we speak about when we said our words of assurance earlier today. But we tell the stories of Sammy Rangel. We tell the stories of a person like of the Apostle Paul because it's important for us to know their stories. It's important for us to know that no one is beyond the pale. No one is beyond the reach of God in one way or another. No one is in such a place where the constellation, the dots of their life, cannot be at a moment's notice rearranged and changed. And we think about in the world that we are in right now, and we think about the folks that we hear on the TV, on social media that are spewing hate and venom in one way or another. And it's important for us to remember that that need not be the final words that come out of their mouths, that like Sammy Rangel, like the Apostle Paul, they too may change. But here's the deal. I look out at all of you wonderful people every Sunday, meet with you during the week, and there are not a whole lot of Sammy Rangels and Apostle Pauls right here, right? I don't see a whole lot of people that if we were lining up everyone and say, let's put the folks that are on the good side over here and those that are clearly beyond the pale over here, Sammy Rangel, Paul, I don't see any of you over here. I see you over here. Good people, living your lives, doing the best that you can in your lives. And that's why one of the things that I love about the story that Steve read for us, it's not just about Paul. There's another figure there. There's Ananias. Ananias is this disciple in Damascus. Ananias, by being identified as a disciple, is a person that we know has already made a choice in his life. You had to choose if you were going to be a follower of Jesus, because that was not a given by any means. You weren't born into that. And when you made a choice like that, you knew that you were making a choice that might indeed cost you your life. It had cost Jesus his life. It had cost Stephen his life. It had cost others their lives. You knew that this was a key choice to make. And you also knew, if you were being identified as a disciple, that you were part of a community that was doing amazing things already by this time. What we know about the early church is that they were the open door that welcomed in the widows and the orphans and the strangers. They were the ones that pooled all of their resources together so that they might live in community, so that nobody would be left wanting. They were the description of what we think about in terms of radical hospitality. So if we're going to line up Ananias on whether they're a good person or a bad person, he's very clearly, like all of you, on that good side, doing all that he can in his life to live out the faith that he has inherited, as I see each of you doing week in and week out. But here's the other thing about Ananias. Just like us, he also has fears that control him. He also has implicit biases that will control him. We live in a world right now where there are many opinion makers that are trying to craft our opinions and our thoughts on the basis of fear. Fear of the other, fear of the unknown, fear of the new. All sorts of fears that are being stoked because they know that fear is a primary motivating force. For Ananias, his fear was probably pretty legitimate. I mean, after all, when he has this conversation with God and God says to him, Ananias, I got a guy coming to Damascus I'd like you to go visit. And Ananias says, well, who would that be, God? And God says, well, it's Saul of Tarsus. And Ananias, you can just say, excuse me, let's have another conversation here. You know who this man is, right, God? You know what he has done. You know why he's here. You know he's all about binding up people. You know he was there at the stoning. You know it's people like me. It's people like me that he's coming for. Why, God, would I want to be in the same room with this man? And Ananias is operating out of a place of very clear and understandable fear for his very life. And it clouds, at least momentarily, his ability to embrace the moment that is there. Fear will do that to us, and it will do it to the best of people. St. Francis had a fear of lepers, had a fear of lepers that when he saw a leper early on in his ministry coming his way, he would turn tail and get out of there so as to not have to confront the leper. And we know that. We have seen that in our world. We have seen just the name and the nature of who the leper is that we are afraid of change. When AIDS became a reality in the 80s and the 90s, there were so many doctors and healthcare professionals and so many other people that refused to be in the presence of someone who had AIDS, to refuse to touch a person who had AIDS, lest they get that, quote, gay disease that was coming their way. That was at that time the leprosy of our world that we were afraid of and scared of, and we pushed it away. Fear will do that to us. It will take those of us who are wonderful and good people, and it will in some ways cut us in half from all that God is to be. And if it isn't fear, it may be our implicit biases that are part of our world, part of the things, part of the world that we swim in, part of all the cultural messages that we are given day in and day out that begin to impact the way that we think without even realizing it. Whether it is our biases dealing with gender choice, dealing with sexual orientation, dealing with skin color, dealing with creed, dealing with place of our origin, we have these implicit biases that impact our life and the way that we are with one another. And the result of that is we, good people, good, faithful people, will act in ways in which we are not living out the fullness of what God has called us to be. But sometimes wonderful things happen. The wonderful things that happen is sometimes the very people that represent our fears, our biases, through no fault of their own, they just happen to represent those things, come to us face to face. Come to us face to face. Early on, after St. Francis had been doing a lot of those turning tails and running away from the leper, he heard a bell ringing, the story is told. And the bell is what all the lepers in the community, those they lived up in the hills, what they had to wear so that people knew there was a leper coming into the community. And St. Francis, the story is said, turned around and walked away, but stopped dead in his tracks and said, "This has to stop," and then turned back around and went and embraced that leper who had done nothing other than contract a disease. And he embraced and kissed that leper, and from that point on, St. Francis's fear of leprosy was gone. I had a conversation the other day with a colleague of mine who was raised in a very conservative Christian tradition, raised in a Christian tradition in which he says homosexuality was considered to be the greatest of sins. And he had done great and good work within this tradition. He was a missionary, had gone to places in the world and shared the good news. And then one day, his daughter said, "Dad, can I talk to you and Mom?" And he said, "Sure, honey, what's up?" And his daughter said, "I need you all to know that I am gay." And when he wrote to me about this, he said, "I asked her to just give me some time to process." He said, "I had to figure out what was happening, because the dots of his life that he had arranged into a constellation that seemed to work were all of a sudden falling apart in the face of this daughter who he loved so greatly." And he tried to fall back upon things like hate the sin, love the sinner. But he said, "I couldn't fall back there, because at its basis, it's about hate. And there is no space, I came to understand and realize, in God's world for hate. That it has to be about love." And so he said, I began to understand that which is what I had grown up and had been the props of my life could no longer be there. And I had to relearn and reface and come to understand a God of far greater love than I had ever imagined. And he wrote to me and he says, 7 years later, the greatest gift of my life has been that my daughter said that she is gay. The greatest gift of my life has been that moment when my daughter shared that with me, because it opened up to me a God of love that I had not known until that point. He was gifted with the chance of having that which he had created as an implicit bias that he was afraid of was right in his face and reached out to him in a way that he could not avoid. But what's amazing about this story that we just had heard read from Stieg, what's amazing about this story is Ananias is still afraid. It's very clear. You don't have this sense of resolution where God says, "Ananias, I need you to just go do this." And Ananias says, "Yeah, okay, fine. I got it. I was afraid, but no longer am I." You get the very clear feeling as the story is told that Ananias is still very afraid. Still very afraid, and yet, he takes that moment, trusting in God, that if God has called him into that moment, that he can be the presence of the Spirit right there for this man Saul. That he can be the hands of Christ right there for this man Saul. And Ananias takes his hands and touches them on the eyes of Saul. And as it says, all of a sudden, it's as if scales fell away. And Saul could now see. Saul, who had been blind for 3 days, who had not been eating for 3 days, was clearly in a place of angst and trouble, all of a sudden was now whole. Saul could not have become Paul, I am convinced, without the touch of Ananias, who was afraid of him, touching him anyway. Paul could not have become the person that has changed the lives for each one of us because of the profoundness of his theology that has shaped our faith without the touch of Ananias, who is still afraid of him. We are better because of that moment. And Paul begins at that point, it says, within the next days to begin to proclaim the good news. And Saul, becomes the Apostle Paul at that moment. Not, I'm convinced, on that road is when the bright light hits him and he hears God saying, "Why are you persecuting me?" That's not the moment. The moment is when the one who is afraid of him reaches out and touches him anyway and changes not only Paul's life, but I can guarantee you changes his own life as well. I can guarantee you that Ananias no longer operates from that place of fear. I don't think it happens often in any of our lives, maybe once, maybe twice, that we are given the chance. We are given the chance out of our own fears to touch the life of one who we are afraid of, one that we may be biased against. And in that process of our own touch changing their life and changing our own, I do not think it is something that happens very often. I think oftentimes it's just sort of something that we just happen to be finally able to see a truth that we hadn't seen. But every now and then, in the midst of our fears, we still hear that call. And my prayer for each of us is that we may have the presence that Ananias had, good people that we are, good people like Ananias, to be in that communication with God, to be able to speak our truth to God, to be able to speak our fears to God, and yet not be constrained by those fears. For if God has called us to step forward and reach out and touch someone, that we might in fact have the strength to do so. For if we want to be the change in this world, it can't just be because we reach out and touch the folks who agree with us, who are in the same boat with us. It's going to become when we ourselves have had the ability to step out of our own fears and our own biases and reach out to those who may represent everything that we are afraid of. And yet, in that process, we move forward. And so when we come here to the table, it's a funny thing, isn't it, that when the disciples were gathered there with Jesus on that last night, they didn't know that when he talked about his body being broken, that they were too going to be asked to be broken, to offer of themselves to a world that was in great need. They didn't know it on that Last Supper, but we do. We who gather know that in the light of that reality, in the light of that moment, that is the call that is given to us. That in a world that needs people to give of their life to them, we are asked to do that. They didn't know that they would be confronting their own fears and their own biases from that point forward and would be called to reach out beyond all of them. Jesus knew it, and we know it. We know the story. We hear the story and we know that we too have been called to the very same thing. So in so many ways, we are in a very different place than the disciples were on that night. We are in a place of knowledge and wisdom that they didn't know. But they came to know it. And because they came to know it, and because they then came to live it, the early church was established. And because the early church was established, this church continues to this day in the very same light. In the very same light of knowing that as the bread is broken, we too are called to offer ourselves to a world. That as we are, as Jesus ushers a call to be love and peace, even for those that we struggle with, we too are called to that. And so it's with great joy that we gathered together, it is joy mixed with a wonderful reality of challenge that makes life so full and rich that we come to this table and we remember on that night, Jesus took a loaf of bread, probably not this one, as this one is gluten-free, nut-free, fruit-free, all free. Just want to get that out there to everyone. Took a loaf of bread, and he broke it. And he said, this is my body that has been broken for you. Do this in remembrance of me. And in the same way, he took a cup, and he poured into that cup the wine, and he said, this is the blood of the new covenant. My blood that has, this is the new covenant, my blood that has been shed for you. Do this also in remembrance of me for the forgiveness of all of our sins. So ministering in his name, I invite you to come forward and to enjoy the feast of this table and enjoy and live into the challenge that they embrace to give of our lives as life was given to us, to offer ourselves to one another as life has been offered to us. To be the presence in this world. Amen.